The Guardian.
Now, naturally, people want to know what Brexit will mean.
Brexit means Brexit. Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means breakfast.
Breakfast. Brexit.
So in closing, I'd simply say this. Brexit means Brexit.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian's new Brexit podcast, Brexit Means. I'm John Henley, and I hope this will be a regular rendezvous as we set out to explore in a bit more depth than is usually possible some of the multitude of questions raised by Britain's momentous decision in June to leave the European Union. I'll be talking to Britons and Europeans, to leavers and remainers, politicians and ordinary people, economists, businessmen, lawyers, researchers, campaigners, and many more about what Brexit means for them, for the UK and for the EU, about how it might work and how it might not. It'll be a podcast that can't get enough of experts, and we want to hear from you, too. In future episodes, we'll be digging deep into Article 50, examining the rights of Brits abroad and EU nationals in the UK, asking how Brexit might affect the city, and trying to work out exactly what the single market is and how it differs from the customs union. We'll be talking about Brexit and Scotland, about the Great Repeal Bill, the work of the government's departments dealing with what's been called the biggest challenge facing the British civil service since World War II, and the role that Brussels and the EU27 will play in Brexit. But in this first mini-episode, we thought we'd take a bit of a skate through what's happened so far. A recap of sorts.
Well, at 20 minutes to five, we can now say the decision taken in 1975 by this country to join the common market has been reversed by this referendum to leave the EU. We are absolutely clear now that there is no way that the Remain side can win. It looks as though the gap's going to be something like 52 to 48, so a four-point lead for leaving the EU.
So, it's been less than 6 months since referendum day, and on one level, an awful lot has happened. On another, of course, nothing very much has happened at all. Despite the Prime Minister's protestations that Brexit means Brexit, we're not a lot closer to knowing what Brexit will actually mean, or how it might affect us. But how did it all begin? Well, you could go a long way back. The fact that Britain is an island, physically separated from Europe, that it hasn't been invaded for nearly 1,000 years, that not so very long ago it ruled half the world, all those feed into a sort of British exceptionalism that somehow sits ill with membership of the European club that this country joined in 1973. There's the fact the Brits always saw the EU as a business, not a political proposition. That large sections of the British media have shamelessly and quite brutally bashed Europe for the last 40 years, that politicians have never really been more than lukewarm, the EU, after all, wins nobody's votes, and that relations with Brussels itself have rarely been smooth. Plus, of course, the now familiar issues of immigration. There are 3 million EU migrants living in the UK, and the economic uncertainty for many, caused by globalisation and rapid technological change. For all kinds of different and often not altogether logical reasons, Britain was ready to give the status quo, part of which it saw as being the EU, a good kick. More concretely, Brexit began when the then Prime Minister David Cameron promised in January 2013 that if his Conservative Party won the 2015 elections, he would deliver a referendum on Britain's membership of the EU.
We will give the British people a referendum with a very simple in or out choice: to stay in the European Union on these new terms or to come out altogether. It will be an in-out referendum.
Now, he felt obliged to do this largely because Nigel Farage's UKIP and the Eurosceptic wing of his own party, a Tory internal problem for decades, were going great guns, and Cameron needed to shore up his vote. Having duly, if rather unexpectedly, won in February this year, Cameron announced the date, June the 23rd. Cue, eventually, an odd and rather divisive campaign, after Cameron allowed his cabinet to follow their own elbows. The government, which is to say mainly Cameron and Chancellor George Osborne, focused on what Britain and its citizens stood to lose economically. Rapidly dubbed by Leavers Project Fear, this was typified by Osborne's so-called punishment budget 10 days before the vote.
Legislating for the kind of measures required to tackle a large structural deficit takes time, and Britain would need to get on with it. Now, you can do it by raising taxes, you can do it by cutting spending. Almost certainly, you'd have to do both.
The Leavers, meanwhile, led by the likes of Michael Gove and Boris Johnson, with Farage alternately sniping and egging on from the sidelines, focused on a simple and powerful message. Take back control. Of borders, budgets, judiciary. They also spun even more outrageous lies than the Remainers. The EU costs us £350 million a week. 70 million Turks are about to invade. And in perhaps one of the most significant utterances of the campaign, Gove also said,
I think the people in this country have had enough of experts.
Voting day was rainy, remember? And everyone went to bed after they'd heard Farage say he thought he'd lost. But he hadn't. By 52% of the vote to 48%, Britain had chosen to leave the EU. The government was plunged into utter turmoil. Within hours, Cameron had resigned.
This is not a decision I've taken lightly, but I do believe it's in the national interest to have a period of stability and then the new leadership required.
Just 2 days later, he headed off for his last Brussels summit, at which the EU27 and the Brussels institutions, deeply shocked, came out with a couple of lines that they've repeated an awful lot of times since. First, no negotiation without notification. By which they mean that no substantive talks on Britain's exit could begin until the UK had triggered Article 50, which is the formal two-year exit process with whose existence we all suddenly became acquainted. Secondly, the EU's four fundamental freedoms, the rights and obligations represented by the free movement of goods, of capital, of services and people, were indivisible. In other words, if Britain wanted to control EU immigration, it would not be able to retain barrier-free access to the EU's single market of 500 million people. They also said Britain should get out as soon as possible, to avoid uncertainty and disruption, and above all, with key elections due next year, in which Eurosceptic parties are set to do well, to avoid contagion. In any event, Britain had to be out by the time of the next European elections in spring 2019, and that implied triggering Article 50 by spring 2017. It steadily became clear, too, that leaving will actually require at least two and quite possibly three separate negotiations. The Article 50 talks to secure a leaving deal, the divorce, as it were, then a long-term final trade deal that will determine Britain's future relationship with the EU, and without which trade would have to be carried out on World Trade Organization terms, which means costly tariffs that everybody is eager to avoid. And, in all probability, some kind of interim agreement that would tide things over, because the final deal could take years, maybe up to a decade, to negotiate. Canada's just sealed one, and it took 7 years. On July the 13th, Theresa May, having won a Tory leadership campaign that saw off to the stupefaction of many, both Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, with the help of a slogan, Brexit means Brexit, behind whose opacity she is still effectively hiding, walked into number 10.
I have just been to Buckingham Palace, where Her Majesty the Queen has asked me to form a new government.
And promptly appointed Johnson, David Davis and Liam Fox as her three Brexiteers-in-chief. By early August, the Prime Minister was embarking on a bit of a tour of European capitals and touting a new mantra. She wanted, she said, a bespoke deal for Britain. A deal unlike any other deal reached by third countries with the EU. A solution that addresses the concerns of British people about free movement while getting the best possible deal on trade in goods and services. By a bit later that month, the battle lines were being drawn, and it was becoming clear that there were deep divisions in the government. Brexiteers were pushing for a rapid Brexit that would leave Britain outside the single market. This became known as a hard Brexit. Many who had voted Remain, armed with economists' estimates that a hard Brexit could cost as much as 4% of GDP, wanted to stay in the single market, and that became known as a soft Brexit. In September, it emerged that the government's top red line in the upcoming negotiations would be controlling immigration, and that it did not intend to give Parliament a vote on triggering Article 50. pressed by a number of outraged MPs in Parliament, May said for the first time,
"We will not reveal our hand prematurely, and we will not provide a running commentary on every twist and turn of the negotiation."
Fully back in business in October, May delivered herself at the Tory party conference of a speech that seemed to many people to say more about the government's objectives than had been revealed by anyone thus far.
"We will invoke Article 50 no later than the end of March next year."
And she gave a few very heavy hints that seemed to suggest, because her top priorities were controlling immigration and leaving the jurisdiction of the European courts, that Britain could well be leaving the single market when it leaves the European Union. In Europe, they were aghast at the whole tone of the conference. The Home Secretary, for example, Amber Rudd, floated a swiftly withdrawn proposal to force companies to record and report the number of foreign workers that they employed. But they were at least happy on the continent to have a bit of clarity on the timing. Pretty soon, though, the pushback against a hard Brexit got underway. Business organisations, including the CBI, argued that a hard Brexit would be catastrophic for the economy. A cross-party group of parliamentarians began pushing for parliamentary scrutiny and for MPs to have a vote on the government's negotiating strategy. EU leaders, in turn, began ramping up their rhetoric on the impossibility of both remaining part of the single market while also curbing immigration. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, seemed to toughen her stance in the wake of the Conservative conference, and the French President, François Hollande, was particularly tough. There must, he said, be a threat. There must be a risk. There must be a price to Brexit. For the EU, this is a question of solidarity and of survival. It has to be said that approval of the EU has skyrocketed across the bloc in the wake of the Brexit vote. But for the EU, this is not about punishing Britain, it's about making sure that any other member state that gets it into its head to leave understands that that's not going to be easy. The EU's red line in the upcoming negotiations is, therefore, really quite straightforward. Britain must end up with a deal that is manifestly and significantly worse than EU membership. By late October, the pound was plumbing record 30-year lows on the back of mounting fears of a hard Brexit. And there was the first hint of consumer price rises to come. Unilever and Tesco, for example, engaged in a tense standoff over planned price rises that risked costing British shoppers their beloved Marmite. Banks were starting to talk seriously about leaving the city, even before they risk losing their passporting rights to sell services across the Union. And cities like Paris, Frankfurt and Dublin all vied to welcome the exodus. The Japanese car maker, Nissan, was also given still unspecified assurances that eventually persuaded it to stay in the UK and build two new models in Sunderland. Theresa May also went to her first EU summit. She got to speak for 10 minutes at 1 o'clock in the morning, as EU leaders continued to insist on the complete impossibility of any compromise on free movement and tariff-free access to the single market. She did, though, ruffle plenty of feathers by insisting that Britain wanted to remain a full and influential member of the EU, playing a major role in decision-making until the moment it leaves. In November, there was a bit of an earthquake. The High Court ruled that the government couldn't trigger Article 50 alone, but must get Parliament's approval first. This was not, it's worth recalling, a ruling on Brexit itself, but on the process of Brexit. But that didn't stop arch-Brexiteers complaining about unelected judges trying to thwart the will of the people. The government has said it will appeal, and the Supreme Court is due to start hearing that next week. But many observers thought parliamentary involvement would inevitably make a hard Brexit less likely, and therefore sterling soared. The EU, meanwhile, fretted that this might mean the whole process would be delayed, although the government has insisted it absolutely wouldn't. Donald Trump's unexpected victory in the US presidential election has thrown up any number of extra questions. Would his self-professed antipathy to NATO, for example, mean that the UK's defence and security capability might be somehow used as a negotiating card in Brexit talks? Or would the EU27 hold out for the toughest possible deal to head off the populist tide across Europe? As with so much to do with Brexit, no one actually knows. And that really brings us pretty much up to date. There's still an enormous amount that we don't know. The economy is hanging on in there, hasn't yet fallen off a cliff, and that encourages leavers no end. But it's worth remembering, of course, that Brexit hasn't actually happened yet, nor indeed has it even begun to happen. Confusion continues to reign over what exactly the government wants. Businesses are pleading, in the main, for a soft Brexit, or at the very least, for a good transitional deal, close to the current status quo, that would ease the unimaginable risks of Britain crashing out of the EU with no trade or regulatory safety net when the two-year Article 50 talks are concluded. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson continues to blunder his way around Europe, making jokes about BMWs and Prosecco, and promising what an increasing number of increasingly frustrated European officials see as the impossible. Meanwhile, assorted memos and reports and leaks suggest that the process of Brexit is going to be so long and so complex that it risks overwhelming the government and the civil service. We may, one leaked analysis suggested, need 30,000 more functionaries to complete it. And the Chancellor revealed in his autumn statement that the direct cost of Brexit to the public finances through lower growth, higher inflation, less revenue, will be in the order of £59 billion. The respected Institute for Fiscal Studies, meanwhile, predicted the post-Brexit wage squeeze on British workers could last a decade and prove the biggest in 70 years, thanks to the falling pound and continuing economic uncertainty. So, heartened by former Prime Ministers Tony Blair and John Major, who see a hard Brexit as an act of unparalleled economic self-harm and are convinced it can be reversed, possibly even through a second referendum, MPs and political figures from the major parties are beginning, quietly, to mobilise for a long-haul campaign against the kind of clean, hard break with the EU and the single market that some leading Brexit campaigners favour. How Brexit plays out will, it's becoming increasingly clear, be determined not just by the EU27, who will, remember, decide what Brexit means Brexit actually means, but also by how Theresa May manages the gulf between the soft and the hard Brexiters in her own party and in the country as a whole. Nearly 6 months after it voted to leave the EU, Britain and the Conservative Party is as deeply divided over Europe as it ever was. Next time on Brexit Means, we're looking into all things Article 50. What it means, how it works, who gets to trigger it. But we want your input too. What do you want to know about Article 50? And what are we missing? Email us your questions to brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. And make sure you subscribe to Brexit Means through your podcast app or at the iTunes store. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/Guardian.